what I'd like to do in this session is look at how we can establish this view of emptiness by investigating ourselves as a person. So when we want to investigate the nature of reality, how things exist, of course we can investigate any particular object, physical object, the body, the mind, anything. But often it's recommended that in our initial Vipassana practice, investigating the nature of reality, that we focus on ourselves as a person. Because this is something very familiar to us, me, the person, and also that's where we start to sort of go wrong, where we grasp onto this me here, grasp onto this independent me called self, and thereby grasp onto an independent objective world. So we're going to look at how we can, in a very systematic way, investigate how do I exist as a person. So remember, when we talk here about selflessness or even emptiness, we're not saying that there's no me or no person. There's no Buddhist tradition that accepts this. What we are trying to do is to work out, how do I exist? How does this me exist, this person exist? And so that's what we're going to be looking at. And to begin that, I'd like to start with a short meditation so we're a bit familiar with what we're going to talk about. Okay, so make yourselves nice and comfortable. So as always, we begin by preparing the body, settling the body into a state of ease and relaxation, keeping the back nice and straight, and at the same time, the entire body completely relaxed, completely at ease. Using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to regulate or control the breath in any way. And then setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future, simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And now narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of breath at the entrance of the nostrils throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. Now, do you have a sense that there's a me here who is trying to relax the body and who is trying to focus the mind on the breath? A me that does not seem to depend upon anything else to exist. Do you have this experience of this me? Can this me be found anywhere? Where is the me who is trying to relax the body? Is the body simply trying to relax itself? Or is there a me separate from the body who is trying to relax the body? If there seems to be a me separate from the body who is trying to relax the body, where is this need? So investigate thoroughly and see if you can find this me who is trying to relax the body. And where is the me who is trying to focus the mind on the breath? Is the mind simply trying to focus itself? Or is there a me separate from the mind who is trying to focus the mind? If there seems to be a me separate from the mind, who is trying to focus the mind, where is this me? So again, investigate thoroughly. See if you can find the me who is trying to focus the mind on the breath. Now, in your direct experience, what is actually here? There is a constant flow of physical change that is called the body. And there is a constant flow of mental experience that is called the mind. if there's nothing more than the body and the mind here, then where is the me who is trying to become the master or controller of this body and mind? Where is this me who is trying to relax the body and focus the mind? However, it's undeniable that there's someone who's experiencing all of this. So how can the me exist if we don't seem to be able to find it? The me exists as something merely labelled on the basis of the body that is sitting here and the mind that is focusing on the breath. Nothing more than this. The merely labelled me is the one trying to bring the body and mind under control. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting within awareness itself. Resting within luminously clear awareness. And we can slowly finish the meditation. So what I'd like to do then, as I mentioned just previously, is have a look at how we come to investigate nature of reality, how we come to investigate ourself as a person, to come to determine how we exist, to come to determine that in fact we are empty of independent existence, that we are empty of inherent existence. And the very simple approach that is often recommended is a meditative approach called the Four Essential Points. The first point, and what we've been discussing today in this process is very well laid out in a book from His Holiness Dalai Lama called How to See Yourself as You Really Are. So that's a good book to bring in the idea of emptiness and dependent arising and how to go about meditating on it. And in that book, the first point here is called Identifying the Target. Any of you who've studied this in more detail, the technical term that's often used here is identifying the object of negation. But basically what we're saying here is that the first step is to first clearly identify how we see ourselves existing. Because now we're grasping onto the belief that we exist inherently, independently. And so in this meditation then, of course, if we exist inherently or independently, then we must be findable. And so we are going to then search and to see if there is this independent, findable me here. So of course, if we're going to search for it, we have to have a clear picture of what this independent me looks like. For example, if you were going to look for a person, a particular person, in a room full of people, if you didn't have a clear picture of what that person looks like, you wouldn't be sure whether they're in that room or not. Likewise here, if we don't really have a clear picture of how we see ourselves existing, then when we do the search, it will be inconclusive. So this is the most important point in the whole process. If we get this right, the rest is a lot easier. So here again, we are simply to get a feeling, a picture of how we see ourselves existing. So often then, in the meditation, of course, when we sit down to meditate, we relax the body, relax the mind, then this self-grasping often is a little bit reduced. So we don't have often a very strong sense of me when we're in that quiet meditative state. So as a beginner, then often it's recommended here at the beginning of the meditation is to think of or imagine a situation where you have a strong sense of me. So sometimes they say, imagine someone is criticizing you or blaming you for something you never did. Normally, if that happens, we have a strong sense of me. You know, how dare you blame me for that? And it seems to be somehow here, the me that's being blamed. Also, another example would be, imagine someone's praising you for something good that you did. Usually when someone praises us like that, we have a very strong sense of me. Oh, I am wonderful. You know, wonderful me. And again, it seems to be somewhere here, this me that's being praised. So, therefore, when we are learning this meditation, we can do this at the beginning. It's just think of a situation where we have a strong sense of me, and then just notice what does that me look like? And just sit with that a moment. And then, of course, we'll have that sense that there is this me, seems to be really it doesn't seem to really depend on anything else to exist. It seems to be really there, self-existent. If that's the case, if we really exist in that way, we should be findable if we search. So this is the first step, is just to get a clear picture of how we see ourselves existing instinctively. Of course, this is not an intellectual process. We're not trying to intellectualize who we think we are or how we think we exist. This, because remember, our behavior is not based on our intellectual understanding. So here is to just get a sense of our instinctive sense of me. The second point is called, in His Holiness' book, Limiting the Possibilities. The technical term here in the book, in the manuals, usually is something like establishing the pervasion. What this means is that if there really is an independent me, it must be findable. And there are only really two places to look. And that is, if that me, independent me, really exists, it must either be the same as the body and the mind or different than the body and the mind. And if it doesn't exist in either of those two places, it cannot exist. So that's all we're doing here in the second stage, is understanding where we have to search. We have to search either amongst the body and the mind, either the me is the same as the body and the mind, or it's somewhere else, different. And so if we search in those two places and we don't find the me, it cannot exist, the independent me. So we haven't begun the search yet. And so the search is, we search in those two places, which are the next two steps. And we can do that search in either order. Usually it's presented as searching first, is the me the same as the body and the mind? And so here, when we search, then we can search amongst the body and amongst the mind. Again, in either order. So this me that seems to be here, this me that seems to be trying to relax the body and focus the mind on the breath, is that me to be found anywhere amongst the body? Is that me to be found anywhere amongst the mind? If we don't find the me anywhere amongst the body and the mind, the only other place to search is that the me must be something different than the body and the mind. If the me is actually different than the body and the mind, then we must be able to take away the body and take away the mind and be left with the me. But this is easy to discount because we never have a sense of me apart from on the basis of the body and the mind. We never have a sense of me over there. The sense of me is always in connection with some aspect of the body and the mind. But to be complete in the search, we need to actually still do that search. But the only sensible place the me could exist is the same as the body and the mind. And so if we do this search, and if we don't find the me amongst the body, amongst the mind, or different than the body and the mind, then the me, the independent, findable me, cannot exist. And so if we do this search and we don't find the me, then we stop searching and we simply rest in that experience of not finding. That experience of not finding the me is an experience of emptiness. And we need to hold that experience as long as we can to familiarize ourselves with the fact that the me is not findable. Now, often what happens when people begin this meditative process, one of the most common faults or places people go wrong is right here, is that they don't, We don't have a clear picture of this me, this independent me that seems to be here. And then what happens is, when we do the search, then instead of looking for the instinctive sense of me, people start to look for their intellectual idea of who they think they are. Oh yes, on the subtle mental continuum, that's me. I don't think if someone is criticizing us, we're identifying with the subtle mental continuum as the me that's being criticized somehow. If we were, we wouldn't react. But when we get criticized wrongly, we're not identifying with some subtle stream of mental consciousness as me. We have a very strong, solid sense of me. So remember that when we do the search, we need to look directly for the me that we're grasping onto and not start intellectualizing the search and start to think, oh yes, I am the stream of awareness, or it's my subtle mind that's the me, and so forth. Then we're just intellectualizing the process. For example, if you're going to look for a person in a crowded room, you just need to have a clear picture of what that person looks like. And then when you do the search, we don't intellectualize the search, do we? We don't sit there going, I wonder if this person, how old they are and where they're from and, you know, what type of person they are and so forth. We don't do that. All we do is, based on our clear picture of the person, we just scan the room. We go, no, not here. So the same thing here. We have to have the clear picture of how we see ourselves existing and then scan the body and the mind and look for that me and not intellectualize the process. And that's where often people end up. Of course, they end up with finding something because they intellectualize. They say, yes, I'm the subtle mental continuum, I'm just pure awareness, or I'm this and I'm that. But again, that's just intellectualizing. That's not how we instinctively see ourselves. Now, another common experience that people have is they do this search and then they come up with a lot of fear. And this also is related a little bit to the shamatha practice we were looking at yesterday. Our sense of me is very much based on a solid sense of body and mental activity. Solid sense of body and a continuous stream of mental activity reinforces the sense of me. And we are identifying with these aspects as me. But in the shamatha practice, and also the vipassana practice, we'll start with shamatha practice. In the shamatha practice, if we sit down very quietly in a good posture, then a solid sense of body can simply collapse. And then if we're our mind starts to quieten down in shamatha practice and there's not much mental activity, there's not anything reinforcing a sense of me, no mental activity, no solid sense of body. So a sense of me can completely collapse in the shamatha practice, and then people get a lot of fear, thinking they're going out of existence, they must be doing something wrong in their meditation. Likewise, here in the vipassana practice, we have a strong sense of me, solid sense of me. And then when we're searching for this me, and we're not finding it anywhere, the same thing can happen. We can have a lot of fear because it feels like we're going out of existence. We can't find this me anywhere here, so therefore I don't exist. And therefore people develop fear. So in both of those cases, that fear is completely irrational. We're not going out of existence. The only thing going out of existence is self-grasping, which is actually what we want to eliminate. So if you're having this fear, there's a couple of things to do. One, of course, is to work on our understanding of the view of emptiness, that emptiness does not mean nihilism, and that the thing that's going out of existence is not me, but self-grasping, a false sense of me. But also, if we have the fear, we can ask the question, who's having the fear? Because if you don't exist, there can be no fear. So you're not going out of existence, so you don't have to worry about that. So that's one thing we can do. Another thing that often happens, of course, is people go through this process and they get to an experience of not finding, then of course we stop searching, we don't keep searching, because we've done the search. It's like, you know, if we're looking for a person in the room and we've really scanned the whole room for everybody and we don't find them, then we don't go, oh, maybe I better do it again, you know. You know, if we've done it thoroughly, then there's no need to look again because we've checked thoroughly. Then we just sit with the conclusion, that person's not in the room. If we've done the search thoroughly, the independent me, not findable, does not exist. And then we just simply hold that experience of not finding as long as we can. Now, of course, our concentration tends not to be very good. So if we get to the point of not finding, then often very quickly we either become spaced out or we get distracted by something else. If that happens, it's recommended we go back to the beginning, do the search again, don't find, hold the experience as long as we can. Now, in this practice, and this actually applies to all practices, there are effectively three stages we go through. And I like to use the Tibetan words here because they're very brief and succinct. Go nyam tok. Go means intellectual understanding. So first we look at this view of emptiness, dependent arising, and gain an intellectual understanding of what emptiness means, what emptiness is and what it means and so forth, so that we can have a framework for our practice. But merely gaining a good intellectual understanding of emptiness is not going to really transform our life much at all. What we need to do, of course, is to apply this intellectual understanding in meditation. We need to meditate to come to realize, to come to experience that there is no independent me. And so that's the second stage, is nyam. Nyam means like taste or experience. So then we sit down, we do this search, we come to the point of not finding, we hold that as long as we can. So that's a little taste or experience of emptiness. But again, because our concentration is not very good, this experience is very weak and it very quickly dissipates. But if we have better concentration and we hold that experience can have quite a strong impact on our mind. So much that even after we get out of meditation, that experience is still impacting our mind. We're still affected by that experience, maybe for some minutes, hours, days, or even longer. But eventually it'll wear off, our self-grasping will come back, and it'll be gone. What we want to do, of course, is to stabilize that experience so that it's not just some fleeting experience, but it stays with us longer term. So this is tok, which is realization. And so to have a realization of emptiness or a realization of anything, of course, we're talking about a direct experience. So to have a direct experience of emptiness, we need a very stable and clear mind. We need the mind of shamatha. Anything less than shamatha, our mind is not stable and clear enough to have a realization. The best we can do is some sort of taste that affects us a while and wears off. So if we really want to deepen that and really come to penetrate and have a direct realization of emptiness, we need then the mind of shamatha, a stable, clear mind of shamatha. Then the realization of emptiness is a lasting experience. And through this realization of emptiness, then we can start to eliminate ignorance and mental afflictions. A taste or an experience of emptiness will have an effect of just sort of keeping the lid on the mental afflictions a little bit. You know, if we've had some taste or experience of emptiness and it's still affecting our mind for some minutes or hours or days, during that time, you'll notice that your mind will be a little bit more peaceful and calm. Your mental afflictions will be a little less less strong as normal, less anger and jealousy and so forth, and a little bit weaker. And also you'll feel a bit more connected with other people, more close to other people. But eventually that'll wear off and you'll be back to normal. But realization is, it continues with us. And so by realizing emptiness directly, we can start to wipe out ignorance and mental afflictions. But one direct realization of emptiness is not enough to wipe out all our ignorance and mental afflictions. We have to go through what are called in the Mahayana path, the 10 grounds or 10 bhumis, where we're constantly working on emptiness, realizing again and again and again and again, wiping out more and more ignorance, mental afflictions, until finally we can achieve the final goal of enlightenment. So that's a little bit sort of the stages we go through. So is there any questions about the meditation process or these stages? Yeah.
When you're searching for what do you have to reflect on?
Reflect? Well, again, we have to first get a clear picture of how we see ourselves. Like, if we can imagine, let's say someone's really praising us, we've done something super fantastic. We have a strong sense of me, don't we? Wonderful. And that sense, it often seems to be somewhere here, doesn't it? This me. The me that's being praised. You know, we puff up the chest a bit. You know, this me that's being praised seems to be somewhere here. Is the me being praised? Is it there somewhere? I mean, what is actually here? There's some ribs and muscles and heart and organs. Are any of that the me that's being praised? But see, that's the me that we're identifying with. That's the me we need to look for. And so if we keep that in mind when we're looking, then, you know, if we find something, we go, well, is that the me being praised? You know? Like, if we don't have that clear picture and we look at that, then, and people intellectualize this meditation, they'll come down here and they go, I'm the subtle awareness, you know, I'm just this open, spacious awareness, I'm the subtle mental continuum, you know, come up with all sorts of intellectual ideas. Is that what we're relating to when someone's praising us? I think not. No. When we feel praised, are we resting? Are we just somehow subtle awareness? No. We don't have that sense of me, a subtle awareness. So that's where we need to make sure that in this meditation, we're looking for the me that we're grasping to, not the one that we're intellectualizing.
In the Vedic system, some tenets of Buddhism, they postulate eight consciousness that carries on from one life to another.
Right, that's the next point I'm coming up to. So if there's no more questions about this, I'll answer this, but otherwise I'll answer a couple more and then we'll come to your point.
But what is that awareness of the one that is searching?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's awareness, it's mind. There is mind, there is body, there is me. No one is questioning that. The question is, how do all of these things exist? That's the thing that we're interested in here. And if there is no independent me, then who's the me? You know? And what's the thing that goes from life to life? What's the thing that achieves enlightenment? That's the next thing I'm coming to. But before I go there, if there's any more questions about this, I'll answer that first.
So you say that me is a function of mind?
No.
It's not.
No. If someone's praising you, do you see yourself as a function?
Of course, we don't see it that way. But
that's right. So that's not the me.
But the mind imputes a me onto the aggregator. So isn't that a function of the mind?
Imputation is a function of the mind. Me is not.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course imputation is a function, of course. When we're imputing, that's a function. Okay, then let's go there. So, of course, any system which says there's something after this life has to say what sort of goes from life to life. And of course in Christianity it's the soul that goes to heaven or hell. In other traditions, it's a Atman that goes on and achieves liberation and so forth. So what is it here within Buddhism? Well, now I'm talking, of course, in the Mahayana system here. What is it that not only goes from life to life, but what is the me that exists, the person that exists? If it's not independent, how do I exist? So, of course, the parts of the person is the body and the mind. And so let's say that this is this life, beginning and end. So, within this life, of course, the me that exists is a me that is labelled on the basis of the body and the mind. So let's say that this is the present moment. So the me that exists right now is a me that's labelled on the mind that is present now and the body that is present now. That me is not the body and the mind at the moment. Just like the pen, remember? The pen is not the collection of the parts. The pen is labelled depending on the collection of the parts. Likewise, the me is not the body and the mind. The me is not the collection of the body and the mind. The me is labelled depending on the body and the mind. So the me that exists now, the dependent me, is a me that's labelled on the basis of the mind that is active now and the body that is present now. Okay? And so that, of course, applies throughout this life. So we change in our life because at each point the mind and the body are changing. So remember, we are not the body and the mind collectively. We are labelled, the me, the person is labelled, depending on the body and the mind. So that goes throughout the life. And this, as I said, is the me is merely labelled. So therefore, sometimes you'll hear the term mere I. So the term mere I means merely labelled me, merely labelled person, the dependent me, the one that exists. So this mere I, this me, it's going through life, is a me that's labelled on the basis of the body and the mind that is present in the moment. At the time of death, through the death process, the first four stages of the death process, the coarse body and the coarse mind are shutting down. So in those first four stages, the me that's undergoing that death process is still a me merely labelled on this coarse body and coarse mind that are slowly shutting down. By the end of the fourth stage, the mind has become more subtle and we have a subtle body now manifest, the subtle wind energies and so forth. So over the next three stages of the death process, the me is something merely labelled on the subtle mind which is active and the subtle body which is active. Then at the last stage of the death process, we have the very subtle mind and the very subtle body, the very subtle wind energy active. So at the last stage of the death process, the me that's undergoing that is a me merely labelled on the very subtle mind, very subtle body.
By the very subtle mind.
That's irrelevant. That's irrelevant. We're not talking about, like, when we talk about how does this exist, we're saying its level of existence is merely labelled.
Why?
No. We're not talking about the psychological fact whether or not we happen to be imputing this in every single moment. That's irrelevant. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the level of existence. And the level of existence this pen has is merely labelled, not more than that. It wouldn't make sense for this pen to exist that we have to be imputing into every microsecond.
But are we not being that subconscious?
Yeah. Yeah. So, no, we're not. So, again, when we're talking like this, then it sort of indicates that we're still holding on to something that's doing that. Yeah. Anyway, I'll just continue on here first. So then, at that point of death, then, the very subtle mind exits, disconnects from the coarse body. In the very next moment, we enter into the bardo state. And in the bardo, then we have a subtle mind and subtle body existing. So the me that's going through the bardo is a me labelled on the basis of the subtle mind and subtle body. At the end of the bardo, that subtle mind connects with a fertilised egg in the womb. So again, we have the beginnings of a coarse body, and then that mind becomes coarse. And so the me in the next life is the me that is merely labelled on the basis of the coarse mind and the coarse body that has just begun in the womb. So at all times, we can talk about the mere I. So in Buddhist, here in the Mahayana, the thing that goes from life to life is the mere I. So you can't point to anything. As soon as you point to something, that's grasping. So you can't say that the I is a subtle mental continuum, it's awareness, it's any of those things, because that's grasping. The I that exists is merely labelled on the basis, depending on whatever basis is present. And that basis doesn't have to be the entire body and mind. You know, like, let's say, you know, we see at a distance, we see someone pop their head around the corner. On the basis of just seeing their head, we say, oh, there's Tom. We didn't see their mind, we didn't see their whole body, but on the basis of seeing that part, they say correctly, there is Tom. So we're not talking about having the need for the whole basis to be present to label, but some aspect of the basis is always there for that labelling. So this is the mere I that goes from life to life and achieves liberation. So this is the dependent me, the one that exists.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I still get this weird I as continuing in bardo. Are you saying that once in bardo, I'm aware of the mere I?
You're not aware of...
I'm putting the I onto my aggregates. So whatever,
the bardo being has a sense of I, yes, of course. Of course.
So, no, what happens is that in some parents, they say that at the last moment of death, where all the things get together, fuse here, and then that's it. So then what is it according to the eighth consciousness of Mahamudra, the one that carries on from one life to another?
Yeah, so that's what is active, so what?
That eighth consciousness, they don't define that as mere I.
No, oh, absolutely not.
But then what is that?
No. The eighth consciousness is just the thing, is the concept they use to explain how karmic imprints work and how memories work. It's not the eye.
They work on something.
Sure. Oh, and we have a stream of a consciousness present all the time. Does that mean that's the eye? No. The eye is labelled on that basis.
So far, so good. Yeah, that's fine. But then there's still your consciousness and my consciousness. Sure. Is on one.
Right. So this is a very good point. You know, when we talk about this sort of thing, you know, we hear about we're all one. This is dualistic talk. To have one, you have to have two. We're all one is dualistic. You can't have one without two. So correct, in the original text, they never say one. If you look in the original Sanskrit and Tibetan text, it says things are not two.
Not dual.
Not dual. You can't say one. One is dualistic. What we can say is we're all one nature. We're all one nature of emptiness. But your consciousness and my consciousness are not one. One means identical. Is big and small one? Are they identical? No. Are they two? No. Two means big and small. So big and small are not two. It does not mean one. One means identical, the same. We're not all one big blob. We're not two, meaning we're not big and small. Meaning my mind and your mind are neither the same nor different. Because same and different is dualistic talk.
Yes, you just saw that you have said that are same and different is dualistic talk. But
yeah.
Still,
now we're going on the time.
We're
not the same and we're not different. Not dualistic. Sure, yes.
You're not denying.
No. Absolutely not. Because for us, different means there's two things that are different.
Okay, okay.
There are not two things that are different.
Okay.
So, you know, the thing we need to remember when we talk about dependency, you know, things are interdependent. We think that, oh, that means there's one thing here, and they're connected. That's dualistic. That means different. Big and small come into existence because of relationship. It's the relationship which defines the endpoints. You don't have two things that are connected. You don't have somehow me and you, and there's something connecting us, stringing us together. It's the relationship which defines me and you. Yeah, of course. That stimulates the thought, no?
Yes.
Any other questions?
Who's doing the labeling?
We are. We are labeling the cup.
And what else?
Yeah, we label ourselves, no? We have, when we have a sense of me, then that's labeled, right? But that's not, remember here, that's not the question. The question is, how do things exist? How do things exist? The level of existence, yeah? So, you know, we live in this conceptual world. We're labeling, we're conceptualizing these things with our mind. That's okay.
Permanent.
So this word permanent is another case of a terminology confusion. Because normally often at least in our daily life, when we say something's permanent, what does that mean? It means it lasts forever. And if something's impermanent, it doesn't last forever. Most often. Yeah? That's what we sort of mean when we usually say things are permanent. It means they're never going to finish, never going to end. In Buddhism, that's not the meaning of permanent and impermanent.
No, I don't think I was meaning it in the strict English way, but yeah. It's more from something that has no beginning or end. It just goes on and on.
So you can have something that has no beginning and no end and be impermanent. You can have something with a beginning and end and be permanent. So permanent and impermanent does not tell us how long something exists. Permanent and impermanent only tells us, is this thing changing from one moment to the next or not? Permanent means no, impermanent means yes. So permanent and impermanent just means, is there change occurring or not? It's not talking about how long it's going to last. So what's an example of something that's impermanent that lasts forever? Our mind. What's something that is permanent that lasts for a very short time? The emptiness of an object. Like this pen, if I destroy it, the emptiness of the pen ceases to exist because the pen ceases to exist. Emptiness is not changing from moment to moment. So that's a sort of an example of something that's permanent that could last for a very short time. Yeah. No. I mean, technically that's misleading. Like, for example, the physical world. Superficially, if we don't really look closely, it seems like there are objects moving through time. You know, this pen is moving through time. But actually, if we look down at the very most subtle level, there is no thing moving through time, is there? All that's happening is there's a constant flow of change. And within that constant flow of change, to make sense of it, we create objects that seem to have some continuity, because we need to make sense of this flow. But actually, there's no thing moving through time. Likewise, superficially, it seems like we have a mind, our mind is moving through time. But same as the physical level, the mind is simply a continuum of mental experience unfolding. So there's no mind moving through time. There's just a continual unfolding of mental experience. So technically, to say the mind goes from life to life is a bit misleading. It's like this pen is going through time. Technically, that's not the case. But not objectively. Time is a concept. Let's say this is the mind, and we're sort of expanding it out. So let's say that this is the present moment. Can you point to the present moment?
Not from a quantum physics level, but at the gross level.
We can? So let's say this is the gross level moment. Let's say this is the gross level moment. Let's say it's 1 microsecond. Within that microsecond, we can divide it into 3. The beginning has already finished, so that doesn't exist. The end is yet to come, that doesn't exist. The only thing that exists is this. We can divide this into 3. That has already finished, that's yet to come. We can keep going down, 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 down. You'll never be able to point to the present moment. Impossible. Does that mean the present moment doesn't exist? No. It means, like everything else, present is relative. You can only have present relative to past and future.
So, I would say even time is a relative concept.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
So the moment we say that time is a relative concept, then consciousness evolves over a few years.
Yeah, sure.
Then that means it's relatively it is evolving over a time. You know, we can't talk about the scientific physics space where we say that, you know, it's a multiverse and, you know,
sure.
Time.
Right. So, what's the question?
No, oh. I'm just saying yeah. Consciousness, consciousness is somewhat linear.
In our perspective of the world, yes.
No, but in reality, would you say it is not like that?
Well, in reality, I mean, in terms of ultimate reality, there is no time, is there? Within emptiness. But in our conventional world, there is time existing. But again, it's just a concept that we've developed to explain phenomena, to explain change.
So then you're talking about reincarnation and rebirth.
Yeah.
And then in the Buddhist context, what moves then?
Again, technically nothing moves. What we can say is the mere I which takes rebirth. Because it's just a changing of label. Like the seed and the sprout. You know, the seed is transforming into the sprout. At all points, there is an associated body. So I is labeled on the basis of the body and the mind.
The body goes.
Coarse body, not subtle or very subtle. The stream of consciousness continues. Does it move or go? those words are a bit awkward. Yes, it continues. Yes, the stream of consciousness continues. Shit, yes. 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 But is that stream of consciousness the person? No. The person is merely labeled depending on that and the body. Yeah, of course. And also your mind is also constantly changing.
And also there's no spirit to that, right?
Sorry?
Another person's stream of consciousness may be merged, you know, this
one. Merge, no. Not according to Buddhism, no.
And there's no stream of consciousness.
Not findable. It exists. The stream of consciousness, of course, is a label we are applying to the many moments of consciousness, of course.
Is this the same soul traveling
So if you say that this is soul, then Buddhism would say, yes, soul exists. If you say soul is something unitary, unchanging and permanent, no, it does not exist. So it depends completely on your idea of soul. Sure. So that's okay. It's okay. Okay. Tea break. So let's have a tea break, and then at 3:30 we'll come back, and in our last session I want to focus on how to integrate both the shamatha vipassana practice into daily life.